Four.
Your Honor, this case involves the proper and correct method for determining the amount of damages to an aggrieved person or persons may recover from the Real Estate Recovery Fund. I'd very briefly like to cover the background of this case. I represent three different clients, so Pace, Reed, and Carr. They purchased in October and November of 1975 three separate tracts of land in Orange County from a realtor named Frank Manchak. A number of misrepresentations were made by Mr. Manchak concerning those three separate pieces of property. Suit was filed in 1976. The case went to trial in January of 1980. Took approximately a week. The jury found in favor of the plaintiffs on misrepresentations and unconscionable action. A judgment was entered on behalf of the three plaintiffs in February of 1980. And of course, in accordance with Woods v. Littleton, the damages that the jury awarded of $6,000, $5,000, and $2,000 respectively were trebled, in addition to attorney fees. Therefore, I received a judgment for approximately $43,000. That case was appealed to the Beaumont Court by a 2-1 decision affirmed. This court refused the writ, no reversible error. That writ was refused, I think, in March of 1981. The motion for rehearing was overruled in April of 1981. Therefore, I received a final judgment in April of 1981. At that point, I had the judgment abstracted and recorded. In addition, I got out execution. The execution came back marked nulla bona. At that point in time, in July of 1981, I then applied to the trial court, notifying the Real Estate Commission of my desire to have the Real Estate Commission pay the judgment. The court held a hearing in July of 1981, ordered that treble damages be paid up to $10,000 per individual. Both sides were unhappy with that decision. Both sides appealed to the Ninth Court once again. The Ninth Court, on writing that case, determined that treble damages were not recoverable and that the $10,000 limit, which was in effect from 1975 until 1979, was the applicable limit as opposed to the $20,000 per transaction limit, which came into effect on September 1st, 1979. Now, the first point that I would like to cover concerns treble damages and whether or not treble damages is recoverable under the Real Estate Recovery Fund, Article 6573A, Section 8. Section 8 contains 10 different parts, 10 different paragraphs, and that encompasses some 2 1/4 pages of statutory language. It is my position that the clear intent of the legislature in writing this particular act clearly calls for treble damages. And the reason I say that is because this act became effective May 19, 1975. The Consumer Protection Act had been in effect for some 2 years. This Real Estate Recovery Fund applies to realtors who make misrepresentations, who commit fraud, deceit, false practices, trickery, things like that. It's a whole list of different articles that are valid. Those are all causes of action that would logically be covered under the Consumer Protection Act. The Consumer Protection Act, ever since its inception, provided in 1750b1 that a person who is successful in a cause of action under the Consumer Protection Act may recover up to 3 times his actual damages. Therefore, the language that had been in effect for at least for 2 years prior to the time this act became effective talked in terms of recovering 3 times actual damages. It is my position that if the legislature wanted to limit the amount of damages that an aggrieved person could recover to actual damages, they could have very simply have written into the statute actual damages. As opposed to that, nowhere in the 2 1/4 pages of legislation is the word actual damage or the term actual damages ever used. Rather, the term judgment is used some 24 times, according to my count. It is not, the word judgment is not used in part one or part two. The Attorney General's office is selecting one phrase contained in Part 1, which talks about reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer monetary damages. And they're trying to interpret that to say that this phrase means only recovering actual damages. However, in the line preceding that particular phrase. It says, in the manner provided in this section. Later in this section, specifically part 3, it goes into fairly good detail about the different steps that an aggrieved person must take in order to recover under the real estate recovery fund. First of all, the realtor must have committed an act that is specified in the real estate recovery fund that's being in violation. We had misrepresentations and unconscionable action in our particular cause of action, so therefore we met that particular requirement. Another requirement is that the execution come back nulla bona. We met that particular requirement. There is a requirement that a judgment lien be perfected. We comply with that particular provision. Then, if those steps are met, then you file a verified claim with the trial court, which we did. And in that verified claim, you set out that you are asking the Real Estate Commission to pay the unpaid portion of the judgment. This particular act in Part 3C basically says that if the defendant, Frank Manchak in this case, can pay any portion or has any expectation of paying any portion of the judgment, then all that you are allowed to apply for to the Real Estate Recovery Fund is the remaining balance of the judgment. I think the important language is contained in Part 3B towards the very end of 3B, where it says that the aggrieved person, after he gives the Real Estate Commission 20 days notice, may apply to the court for an order directing payment out of the Real Estate Recovery Fund of the amount unpaid on the judgment. Since it has to have been contemplated by the legislature that at least there was a possibility of treble damages, it seems logical to me that the correct interpretation of this statute would be that the amount unpaid on the judgment would include treble damages. Therefore, it seems the clear intent of the legislature that when they're talking about how much money should be paid out of the Real Estate Recovery Fund, they're talking about the entire judgment.
Counsel, I'd like your comments about Section 8, Part 1A, which says the fund shall be used in the manner provided in this section for reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer
yes, Your Honor.
Monetary damages.
Yes. Right. The monetary damages that they suffered were encompassed in that judgment. And that statute says that those persons should be reimbursed in the manner provided in this section, the entire section, all 10 parts.
I'm aware of the point about the judgment. The thing that is concerning me, in deceptive trade practices cases, people suffer certain damages, and then by way of punishment, they impose treble damages. Now, do you suffer the full treble damages, or is part of it for suffering and part for punitive purposes?
Your Honor, that, of course, depends on what the jury comes back with in their damage award. I'm trying to sidestep the question, but in this case, we were asking for much more than what the jury actually awarded. As I recall, for instance, with Mr. Pace, I think the testimony was that he had suffered approximately $20,000 worth of damage. The jury awarded him $6,000 worth of damage. When that was trebled up to $18,000, it came close to what we were initially alleging as our total.
Well, can we go behind what the jury finds as to what was suffered?
No, Your Honor, I'm not asking the court to go behind what the jury's answer was. I'm saying that it seems to me the purpose of this particular act is for the Real Estate Commission to police its own members. They have a fee that they charge for investigating people who want to be real estate salesmen, and when they initially apply, they have a mechanism in this particular act where they can revoke the license if they have to pay any money on behalf of a realtor who has committed misrepresentations or fraud. They revoke the license. They have subrogation rights. If any money is ever recovered, they have priority on those subrogation rights. They have a special fund where everybody kicks in $10 if the fund drops below $300,000. And it's my understanding that the fund now has in excess of $3 million. A decision in favor of Pace, Manchak, and Carr will not have the adverse effects that the Attorney General's office would lead you to believe. There are very few cases like this the, of course, the Consumer Protection Act was amended in 1979 to pretty much eliminate treble damages. These are the cases that mainly took place from 75 to 79. There are not that many cases left. It's my position, Your Honor, that the clear intent of this statutory language is that even though in some cases perhaps treble damages is more than a plaintiff really suffered, by the clear language of the Act, they are telling the real estate commission to pay the full amount of the judgment, even with its treble damages.
Counselor, could you give the benefit of your thoughts on whether those treble damages are punitive damages, as is ordinarily understood in punitive damages concept?
Your Honor, I do not dispute the fact that there is some punitive damage concept in the Consumer Protection Act. As my understanding, that's why the legislature amended it in 1979. Now, when the legislature amended the Act in 1979, the only changes that were made were twofold. In Part 3, there was one paragraph that talked about providing 20 days notice to the Real Estate Commission. That paragraph was deleted because a different paragraph provided basically the same requirement. In Part 8, the amount of the recovery was increased from $10,000 to $20,000 per transaction, and the total recovery against any one realtor went from $20,000 per calendar year in a total of $40,000 to a total of $50,000. It is basically my contention that with respect to this particular point, that this statute, or at least the amendment in 1979, was a remedial statute that provided an additional remedy to my three plaintiffs in this particular cause of action. The case law, I have cited the case of Villers versus Republic Financial Services, Inc. on page 11 of my brief. That case dealt with an attorney's fee question under Article 2226. Basically, the cause of action had accrued prior to August of 1977 when this Article 2226 was amended. And of course, it provided for recovering attorney's fees on both oral and written contracts after the effective date. That statute was interpreted as being a remedial statute. It pertained to all causes of action that were pending at the time and would control cases that were tried after the effective date of that particular Act, being August 1977. It is also my contention in this particular case, the amendment in 1979 was a remedial statute. It provided an additional remedy. Not only could Pace, Reed, and Carr go against Frank Manchak to try to recover their damages, they could now also go against the Real Estate Recovery Fund. Mr. Garner will cover this particular point in more detail, Your Honor. And that will conclude my presentation, unless there are any further questions on the treble damage provision of the Act.
Thank you, Counsel. The court will hear argument from Mr. Garner on behalf of Respondent Lyon.
May it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Garner will present argument for Clem Lamb at up.
May it please the court, I have the honor of representing Clem and Bertie Lamb before this court today. I have prepared my speech calling ourselves, the Lambs, the respondents, and just like you said, the petitions. It's going to get a little confusing, so I'll try to keep to the Lambs and the commissions so it won't be confusing. The Lambs' position is very simple, and that is that we believe that the $20,000 ceiling is effective as to this case. The point of the statute, which is an issue, the Real Estate Commission has furnished you with these little books. On page 20 is Section 8, Part A, Subsection C, which deals, which is the issue in this case today. That is the provision that sets the limit at $20,000. This provision was originally passed in 1975, and the limit was $10,000. It was amended as of September 1st, 1979, to make it $20,000. The Lamb's position is that this amendment is effective and binds this case. And there's three theories upon which LAMS base their position. The first one is that the amendment of 1979 was a remedial statute, and as such, it was effective immediately and bound all pending litigation at that time. The question really is whether or not it's remedial. If the court decides that it is remedial, then it does bind the litigation. Cases clearly say that. I don't think there's much question about that. The argument on this theory is that the commission believes that it's not remedial, that it is substantive, and the last position is that it is remedial. Extensive cases in our brief address this point. Basically, I think the philosophy behind remedial versus substantive is this. A substantive cause of action brings forth a new cause of action, gives a right where no right was, gives a duty where no duty was, as in our statute in 1975. In 1975, the legislature passed the Recovery Fund Act. And that created rights. That created a cause of action against that fund, and it created a right to recover from that fund, and so it was a substantive act in 1975. The 1979 amendment did not create any new rights, did not create a new cause of action. What it did, it enhanced the cause of action already existing. It enhanced the remedy already in existence. The reasoning of the legislature seems clear to me, and that is the $10,000 limit was inadequate to compensate and to protect the public. The legislature decided that $20,000 would better do this, and they doubled the amount as of September 1st, 1979. Again, we think the law is plain that if it is a remedial statute, that it can be, that it is effective on litigation pending as of the effective date enacted. This leads us straight into our second point, which is that our second theory to support our position. The theory is that this statute, this cause of action, this recovery fund is a creature of the statute. The legislature created it. The legislature has the right to enhance it, to narrow it, to broaden it, or to eliminate it as it sees fit. If the legislature had chosen to eliminate it on September 1st, 1979, we would not be here today. It being a creature of the legislature had that right to completely eliminate it. Lance's position is that they did eliminate the $10,000 ceiling. The $10,000 ceiling no longer exists. As of September 1st, 1979, it ceased to exist because the legislature chose to repeal that statute and bring in a $20,000 ceiling. Our second theory says that if the Lambs cannot recover under the $20,000 ceiling, they can recover nothing at all because the legislature chose to repeal the $10,000 ceiling by the enactment of the $20,000 ceiling.
The case is that this act amended, what is the history of it? The act which made this amendment, did it specifically repeal a section and replace it with a section? Or did it amend that section of it?
It amended the section, Your Honor. And the cases in the book speak, I mean, the cases in the brief speak to whether or not there's a repeal, and that was just covered very quickly. The Texas Real Estate Commission in their brief said, since that version of the act was repealed by the amendment in 1979, since the commission was saying that it was repealed, and since I'm saying that it was repealed, I didn't think there would be too much of a controversy as to whether or not it was repealed.
Well, I don't think the two of you could argue that black is white and that the court would be bound to saying that black is white.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And in my brief, I did cite, I believe it's Mingus versus Wadley, a 1920-some-odd case, a Supreme Court case, which talks about when you have a remedy provided by a statute, which is amended to give a different remedy, perhaps enhance it, perhaps narrow it, that the old remedy must give way to the new remedy. And henceforth, from the date it was enacted, we are controlled by the new remedy.
I don't think you're addressing Judge Wallace's question. Was there a Part 8C before the 79 amendment?
Yes, sir, there was.
And did it say 10,000?
The only difference was it said 10,000.
So all the 79 amendment did was change 10 to 20, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it was not a repeal, it was an amendment.
Well, it is an amendment. An amendment of a statute such as this affects a repeal. And that's where we get into the cases I was talking about, and that is that to amend the statute and put in a new remedy, we're then bound by that new remedy. And the new remedy is controlling.
That, of course, is based upon the proposition that it is a procedural change and not a substantive change. A remedy and not a cause of action.
No, sir, I believe that a substantive cause of action given by the Texas legislature, which is the creation of the legislature, can be completely eliminated if the legislature so chooses.
Well, they can do away with anything that's free.
Right. And whether it's substantive or remedial, we believe that the legislature did away with the $10,000 ceiling.
Even if cases were pending, you're saying the legislature could have, instead of putting $20,000 in that fee, they could put $5.
Yes, sir,
and
they could.
That affected all cases that were pending?
Yes, sir. Oh, well, little bit different there. When you go to $5 rather than...
See, the problem is that the Act in that Section 8 relates to the time of the occurrence of the transaction sued on.
Yes, sir.
And it seemed to me that it was best at that time, whatever rights that the aggrieved party had, would vest as of the time of the transaction.
That's the Commission's position. Our position is that it doesn't vest, and that's my third theory, is that the rights are not fixed until we have more than a mere expectancy.
It seemed to me to be pretty dangerous to hold that the legislature could, by just simply amending that statute, could do away with substantive rights.
Substantive rights, which are created.
If they changed that to $5, it sure ruined a lot of lawsuits.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And yours.
The legislature could have eliminated it altogether. If they chose to do that, it could have ruined a lot of lawsuits. They could choose to eliminate this statute tomorrow across the street here.
Even if cases were pending?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would happen to the money in the fund?
Well, that'd be something that the legislature would have to deal with. The point is that it's a creation of the legislature, and they can enhance it, they can broaden it, they can narrow it, they can eliminate it. It's their pleasure.
Do I understand your position, Counselor, that an act brought under the 75 original act, a cause of action brought under the original act, $10,000 limit, had been reduced to judgment and was pending before the board for payment when this amendment in 79 was made, that would eliminate, repeal the $10,000 provision, and therefore the claimants under that procedure pending before the board for payment of a judgment would be cut off and that'd be wiped out?
You mean if they did choose to do away with the...
Well, not your theory that this was repealed.
Okay, I see
and
what you're saying.
Therefore, you're entitled to $20,000 and nothing.
That's correct.
Which is set out in your brief.
That's correct.
Now, are you arguing that in the situation I've just given you, the judgment's been recovered for $10,000, it's been submitted to the board, but hasn't been paid, that is automatically wiped out by this amendment in 79?
No, Your Honor, because at that point, once it goes to the board, there's an order of the court ordering payment, and that's going to order some amount. If it was prior to September 1st, 1979, and it was for $10,000, then that order would be $10,000. On the other hand, you spoke about several things. One was the judgment and then pending before the board. What the Court of Appeals in Houston did, which I think is a well-reasoned opinion, said that the date of the fixing of the rights was the date of the judgment, which conformed with statute. In our case, March 23rd, 1981. That's the date the rights were fixed. That's when we moved from a mere expectancy to a right to apply to recover from the recovery fund. So you have a whole stages through here as of what the legislature does. If the legislature enacts it in 75 and eliminates in 76, then that cause of action is gone. If it enacts it in 75 and enhances it in 79, then that 79 amendment is binding on litigation then pending. If the legislature eliminates 1983, then they can strike out those rights altogether because it is a creature of the statute. The list of cases is enormous in our brief as to that particular doctrine of law, and that is that if it is a creature of the statute of the legislature has a right to narrow it, broaden it, or eliminate it as it sees fit.
Well, under that theory, why couldn't the legislature wipe out a judgment that was granted pursuant to that act of civil suit?
There is a certain time period as to when the rights vest. And before one of the justices uses the word vest, the rights of this statute never truly vest until after the judgment, after the order. There is no vesting of rights. The cases say very plainly that you have no vested right in expectancy of a continuation of the general laws pertaining exactly to the creation of the a creation of the legislature, that is a special remedy statute. And the cases direct their attention to that also. The distinction is basically that if it's a substantive law, such as this act is substantive, 1975 was a substantive change in the law, I believe that the creation of the legislature, they can't eliminate that, so that they see fit. The third point, third theory that would support our contention, I'll try to be very brief. It's the same thing that the Court of Appeals in Houston has told us, and that is that they're not applying this statute retroactively. What they're saying is that the rights prior to March 23rd, 1981, the date of our judgment against Joe Gaetti and the real estate agent, did not become fixed. Well, our rights were a mere expectancy. All we had was an expectancy at that point. On March 23rd, 1981, our rights became fixed. That's the date that the limit was set, that is the $20,000 limit. That's the date that we had the right to apply. And I think that's important words, right to apply, right to seek relief. Before that time, we couldn't even go into the courthouse. Once we got the judgment, then we could at least come to the courthouse. Now, we had other things to do, such as Mr. Burmeister has told you, the nulla bono and the abstract, et cetera, and some other conditions, but we didn't have the right to apply until March 23rd, 1981. And on that date, the Court of Appeals has held that our rights were fixed that date, and that is the controlling date. I believe it's a very well-reasoned opinion, and I hope this Court chooses to support that idea. The last quick thing, since I've been joined with the Pace case, I would like to mention something about punitive or treble damages very quickly.
You didn't sign that though as a cross point, did
you? No, sir, I did not. The statute says monetary damages. They didn't say actual damages. It didn't say general or special damages. It didn't say general special, but not punitive damages. It just says monetary damages. The legislature, we have a track record on the legislature which says that if the legislature chooses to limit it to actual damages, they'll say actual damages. They did under the Texas Business and Commerce Code. They did in the Texas Trade Practices Act. They used the words, quote, actual damages, close quote. This legislature chose the word damages, monetary damages. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Counsel. We will now hear argument from the state.
May it please the Court, Mr. George Warner will present argument for the State of Texas and the Texas Real Estate Commission.
Six light. May it please the Court. On the issue of treble damages, I will begin and end with the word reimbursing. The legislature established a recovery fund for reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer monetary damages by reason of certain acts committed by a duly licensed real estate broker or salesman. What did the legislators mean when they selected the word reimbursing? Reimbursing means to restore or to put back, and in this case, monetary damages is what is to be restored. The legislature did not intend for treble damages or punitive damages to be paid out of this fund. The legislature intended the fund for restoring to the victims their actual damages only. Treble damages are not a part, do not come within the definition of reimbursing.
Is this act part of a uniform act?
No.
Adopted by many states?
I think a lot of languages, yes, sir, definitely. Treble damages don't fall within the definition of reimbursing because they are extra damages intended to punish the offender for his wrong. In this case, the damages will be paid by a public fund which has done no wrong. We don't believe that the petitioners in this case, in the Pace case, have suffered any punitive damages. And we don't believe that the Texas Real Estate Commission, this public fund which has done no wrong, ought to suffer by being required to pay punitive damages. If the legislature had intended treble damages and punitive damages to be paid from this fund, it could have chosen clearer language. For example, it could have changed the word reimbursing to paying and deleted the reference to monetary damages altogether so that the fund would be designed not for reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer monetary damages, but for paying aggrieved persons who suffer damages. The legislature didn't choose that language. They chose the reimbursing language. And we believe reimbursing limits payment to restoring. And treble damages contain no element of restoration.
Have you done an analysis on how many state statutes use the language actual and direct loss as opposed to the language judgment? Texas statute uses the word judgment. You've got the right to recover the judgment.
No, sir, I have not done that analysis, and I'd like to get to that point.
Well, isn't it true that Minnesota Supreme Court, in applying a statute that said, a similar statute, said that that statute used the language actual and direct loss, and therefore they were denying the treble damage recovery. But they went on to say that the result could have been different had the statute in Minnesota used the word judgment.
Well, we think that the language, the paramount portion of this recovery fund section is 1A, which contains the reimbursing limitations. And we believe that you do not restore punitive damages. They're extra damages. And of course, in this case, they'd be paid by an innocent third party, not by the offender. There's no public policy which favors punitive damages to be paid by an innocent third party.
Wouldn't
in this case,
the realtors to better police themselves, they're the ones that contribute to this fund. Wouldn't the result be, if they had to pay punitive damages out of fund, to better police who they give licenses to?
I have no quarrel with that, but I believe that the language in the statute limits such a payment and denies punitive damages to be paid by this fund. You have to remember that the realtor involved is still subject to a judgment for treble damages. And once the fund pays the actual damages, his license is revoked. And even if he pays that back, he has to reapply, and the policy of the commission, in my experience, has been not to relicense the individual unless he has completely paid the entire judgment to the victims, which would include the treble damage portion. Mr. Burmeister refers to Part 3B and says that it calls for payment of the amount unpaid on the judgment. But 3B also says that you must have a valid judgment on the grounds described in Part 1A. And Part 1A contains the reimbursing limitation, thereby making 3B subordinate to 1A. And therefore, amount unpaid on the judgment should be construed in harmony with that paramount portion to mean the amount of actual damages unpaid on the judgment. Part 3D says that the court may award whatever sum it finds to be payable on the claim. And if that is construed to include treble damages, there may be a conflict. But it, too, is subordinated to Part 1A, as it says, pursuant to and in accordance with the limitations contained in this section, which is Section 8, and Part 1A is the first and, we think, the paramount portion of this section. And it contains the reimbursing limitation. Whatever sum should be construed in harmony with that paramount portion, the reimbursing language, to mean whatever sum of actual damages. Would like to point out that in Part H, C, and D, there is a limitation. $50,000 is the most that can be recovered against any one licensee for all of his misconduct. And $20,000 is the limit for cost for claims arising out of the same transaction. If the legislature intended treble damages to be paid, why are the limits so low? It would take very few, if even more than one, treble damage claim to consume that entire amount, leaving other consumers who may have been victimized by the same licensee absolutely unprotected by this fund. We believe that the reimbursing language limits payment to treble damages. If there is any doubt, we believe that deference should be given to the agency which administers the fund. The fund was established in 75, and for the 8 years since, the Texas Real Estate Commission has denied treble damages as being appropriately paid out of this fund. And what's more, every court in Texas has agreed, except one, and that was the district court in Pace, which was reversed on appeal. The two appellate courts that have looked at the issue, the Pace Court and the Lamb Court, while disagreeing on our other issue, concur that treble or punitive damages should not be paid out of this fund. The legislature has met in at least three regular sessions since 1975, and it has never taken any action to amend the statute. If it meant treble damages to be paid, why didn't the legislature amend the statute in light of a consistent history for 8 years denying treble damages to be paid out of the fund? We believe the silence of the legislature connotes assent to that interpretation, limiting payment to actual damages. And had the legislature intended treble damages to be paid, the statute would have been amended specifically to say that. The legislature said reimbursing. We agree that had they said actual damages, that would have been clearer. But accepting the fact that they didn't say actual damages, what better way could they have intended a result denying treble damages or limiting the fund only to actual damages? And if the legislature intended treble damages to be paid out of this fund, what poorer way could they have selected than to say that the fund was designed for reimbursing when treble damages contain no element of restoration or reimbursing? The fund is designed for reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer monetary damages. And that means restoring to the victims their actual damages only.
Counsel, is this kind of like an insurance policy that will pay the actual damages, but won't pay punitive or exemplary damages?
I would agree, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Up to the policy limits, you can be paid and not beyond that. I think that's what we have here. We wish the limits were higher. We wish that there was more protection. But the commission is bound by the language in the statute, and that language has received support in the courts in Texas from the beginning. On the subject of retroactive application, the question is, do we apply the $20,000 maximum, which became effective in 79, to the facts in these two cases, which occurred in 1975? Is the date of the judgment against the broker the determinative date of which maximum applies, or is it the date on which occurred the grounds of recovery? Mr. Burmeister argues that the focus in the statute is on judgment. What does the statute actually say? In Part 3B, it says you need to have a valid judgment, and that's a procedural prerequisite before you're eligible to be paid out of the fund. But then it says, on the grounds described in Part 1A of this section, that occurs on or after the effective date of this act. So there is an equal emphasis on the judgment and on the date on which occurred the grounds of recovery. In this case, the defrauding of Mr. Burmeister's clients. Part 1A lists the substantive eligibility requirements for payment out of the fund, and they focus on the nature of the act of the broker and the date that act occurred and the relationship of the broker to the victim. Part 3A contains a statute of limitations which runs against payment out of the fund from the accrual of the cause of action, and that certainly refers to the approval of the cause of action? In the beginning, in these two cases back in 1975, Part 3C1 says that the applicant must show that the judgment is based on facts allowing recovery under Part 1A. Not the judgment so much as the facts which underlie that judgment. 3D says that the court may order payment of whatever sum it finds to be payable on the claim. It doesn't say judgment. Part 8D limits $50,000 for claims based on judgments. Again, we're looking through the judgment to the claim which supports it, which underlies it, which is the basis for recovery. Part 8C, which is at issue today, doesn't even contain the word judgment. It says you can be paid up to $20,000 for claims arising out of the same transaction. The statute doesn't emphasize judgments so much as it emphasizes the facts underlying the judgment, the accrual of the cause of action, the grounds of recovery, the transaction. What have the cases said that have looked at this issue? We have three cases, the Fritch case, Hood, and Pace, all of which stand for the principle that the grounds of recovery, the accrual of the cause of action, is the date that determines, and that the judgment is not the determinative date. Fritch said that while the basic element for reimbursement is the judgment, the amount recoverable is the amount based on grounds that occurred on or after the effective date. Hood and Pace agreed. The facts in Hood, in Pace, and in Lamb are all identical. You had a misconduct of the broker back in 1975, and most in Pace and Lamb, and in 78 in Hood. The grounds of recovery, the accrual of the cause of action, occurred prior to the 79 Amendment. But in all three of those cases, the judgment against the broker was rendered after the 79 Amendments. And Hood and Pace denied retroactive application of the new maximum of $20,000 to those facts that had already occurred based on the language in 3B that the judgment must be on grounds that occurred on or after the effective date. Now the Lamb Court takes a different track and says there's a separate cause of action, a separate right of action that Clem and Bertie Lamb had against the commission that didn't accrue until the date of the judgment against the broker. We disagree. There is only one action, one lawsuit with two defendants, and there's two phases. You've got to pursue the broker and get a judgment against the broker, and then you make an application for payment out of the fund. Part 3B says that once you get your judgment, you don't file a separate lawsuit against the commission and provide personal service. You merely file a verified claim in the court in which the judgment was entered, and only 20 days written notice is required. There is no separate right of action. Part 1A says that in listing what you have to do in order to be able to be paid out of the fund, provided recovery is ordered by a court of competent jurisdiction against the broker or salesman. That's the key. And Part 5 says it this way. When the Real Estate Commission receives notice of entry of a judgment, and that's the judgment against the broker, and a hearing is scheduled under Part 3D, that's the separate phase of the lawsuit that's tacked on top at the end seeking payment out of the fund. Part 3A we think is crucial because it establishes a statute of limitation which runs against payment out of the fund from the accrual of the cause of action, in these two cases 1975. If the court in Lamb is correct that there is a separate right of action that accrues against the commission on the date of the judgment against the broker, why does the statute of limitations run from the accrual of the cause of action back in 1975? That presents the incongruous situation of a victim having a cause of action which has accrued, a statute of limitations running, and if he doesn't meet that statute, he will be barred from ever being paid out of the fund even before his right of action against the fund accrued. Plus, the state of Texas, if that statute of limitations is not met, would have a vested right in that as a defense before the victims ever had a right of action against the commission. There simply is no separate right of action or separate lawsuit or separate matter. You really have one matter, one lawsuit, one right of action against the broker and against the commission. And the facts occurred in 75, the cause of action, the accrual of that cause of action occurred in 1975, and if you'll note in 3A, it only says the approval of the cause of action, not the approval of the causes of action. It only speaks of one. In 1975, when Mr. and Mrs. Lamb were defrauded by Joe Guyton, they had a right of action against Joe Guyton and against the commission up to a maximum of $10,000. And we believe that right vested at that point in time. We don't believe the legislature could come along in 79 and change that by either increasing it